are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 18th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, visiting us in studio, the Director of Research for Future Now, Aaron Kleinman, will be here. Whether Trump is hurting red state Republican elections and what it means for state legislatures in 2020. Meanwhile, John Bel Edwards wins in Louisiana, saving health care for 500,000 people. The Bolivian coup turns even uglier as all elected members of Evo Morales' party are threatened with arrest because democracy. It was a crime. It was a moral disaster. Now, a trove of leaked Iranian cables show just what a strategic F-up the Iraq war was. Meanwhile, impeachment support builds. Hearings to continue this week. And Barack Obama introduces the audacity of nope. Meanwhile, in the wake of falsely attributing black leadership support for his Douglas plan, Pete Buttigieg, of course, takes the lead in Iowa. Chris Coons gets a well-deserved primary. Donald Trump visits the hospital for an unscheduled, unannounced visit, which was, of course, perfectly routine. So concerned about being in peak physical top shape.
Healthiest president ever.
I just want to be optimal. Trump issues pardons to convicted and accused war criminals, of course. And tomorrow, big Red for Ed action in Indiana. Over half the teachers, maybe more even. We could talk to a statistician about whether half the teachers or maybe more is really redundant. Will be involved in a labor action in Indiana. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. We are all here. Michael continues his extended jaunt across the country. I know he was on TYT last week. He's tweeting awfully early this morning from L.A., presumably, right? I don't know. That was weird. But I don't know. I just want to just note the effort involved with someone getting up so early to spread the truth on Twitter in West Coast time. Meanwhile, everyone else is here in studio. And just a reminder, there are, in fact, people associated with the show who are getting up at that time to do news. And they put out the AM Quickie, which is a 5-minute headlines of the day's political news that you are going to want to know. So when you walk into the office, nobody's going to hit you with the "did you hear about that?" And you don't know what they're talking about. And then, of course, it sets it up nicely. You will hear more depth to those stories on this program. Sometimes we don't cover all of the stuff. We do our best. AM Quickie, you can sign up at amquickie.com right now. You can find it on any of your most popular podcast servers. I think you can get it via the Alexa. I tried to do something. I'm not sure what happened. I don't know if that actually worked. But maybe I'll hire somebody to do that. That might be a good idea. In the meantime, also just remember this program is supported by folks like you. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Let's jump right into this. Over the weekend, I think we reported on Friday that the Republican National Committee was dumping $1 million in the last couple of days, maybe in like the last day of the governor's race in Louisiana. It's a red state. I think largely people thought that John Bel Edwards would lose. Now, look, he's not my favorite flavor of Democrat. He's probably my least favorite flavor of Democrat, or, well, maybe not, but close. But the difference is, the material difference, the bottom line one, the first one, is that 500,000 people who were allowed to jump on the Medicaid rolls as part of the ACA because he was governor of that state will keep their health insurance, which was likely to have gone away had John Bel Edwards not won. And we will be talking about this with our guest in a moment. But the other thing that's clear is that despite the tremendous reluctance that Nancy Pelosi exhibited, and to some extent still exhibits by narrowing the scope of this impeachment hearing, presumably because impeachment was going to motivate Republican voters beyond their already fairly motivated selves, that it would overwhelm Democrats. The thing that's clear over the elections that have happened in the past couple of weeks is that that's not in play. We can't measure what a lack of impeachment hearing would have done to Democratic turnout. But there's no evidence that it's necessarily juiced it more, but it certainly hasn't suppressed it either. And all the other arguments for impeachment stand. And here's Donald Trump. They're not wearing read the transcript T-shirts behind him. Apparently, that was a bit of a flop last time.
Those didn't do as well as the hats did.
No. And but here he is on stage. He's at a political rally in Bossier City, Louisiana. Bossier City. I've been corrected by our guest. Louisiana. I like to call it Bossier. Bossier or Bossier. Bossier or Bossier. Sometimes they like to call it Bossier. City in Louisiana. Just 4 days ago, this was a day before the election. And here he is explaining why Republicans should come out and vote for his candidate of choice.
In Kentucky, we elected everybody. The governor got brought up in a few short days, 19 points. I went, we made a speech, the whole ticket was there, everybody won big. Governor's a really good guy, but 19 points is a big thing, and he lost by just a few thousand votes. And the headlines the next day, Trump took a loss. I lift him up a lot. So Trump took a loss, so you got to give me a big win, please, okay? Okay?
He's really getting, like, styly now with this stuff. Like, you got to give me a little big, like, he's getting, like, he's really doing, like, the, he's doing, like, what a radio host does.
He's being real cute.
Real cute. Well, that did not work out. He did not get a big win. He did not get a small win. He did not get a win in Louisiana. And the, like I say, the most important thing about that is that 500,000 people will continue to get their health care. And in a moment, we will talk to our guest about the question of redistricting. They did not, Republicans failed to get a supermajority in the legislature, which would have been a guarantee that they're going to redistrict in a horrible way. However, I think North Carolina gave us an example of just how Democrats aren't necessarily on board with the best redistricting or the most judicious one that we might want, because they're individual politicians who have their own agendas. And we will talk about that in a moment. In the meantime, that bell means that someone has just got their wings, and maybe they have also perhaps purchased something from Grove.co. What is Grove.co? Well, they offer healthy, plant-based, non-toxic cleaning products that work. The good ones are actually, more enjoyable to use because you're not worried about, oh, am I poisoning my child? Oh, am I poisoning my cat or my dog? Where do you start and who do you trust in terms of these type of cleaners? Like I say, Grove Collaborative. It's an online marketplace. They do all the curation. They deliver all natural home beauty, personal care products, and they deliver it directly to you. They take the guesswork out of going green because every Grove product is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. What is it? What's the name of that, the soap that I like? What is it? No. The one in the bathroom. The one without the
Myers?
Scent. No. The one in the bath. Forget it. It's well documented that I do not, I don't know if it's documented, that I have a problem with senses, and with smells. And so I'd like to get a specific type of soap that is, what is it? It's, I'm trying to find it right now. Hold on one second. It is, it's basically, soap that has no dyes, no, it's like seventh, I can't remember. It's the clear one. Seventh generation. That's what it is. I use it for my hands. I use it for the dish soap, and I get it super quick via the Grove. They have a bunch of other stuff too, like great sponges and whatnot. But Grove is super helpful because there's so many different natural products out there. I don't have time to go, frankly, research it. I have other things to do. Meanwhile, we're coming up on the holidays. That means that your house is going to get messy, or you're going to have folks over and you want to make it clean. The Grove has amazing limited time festive scents to make your house clean and smell amazing. The site's super easy to use. You can set up recurring shipments, so you don't even have to think about it anymore once you figure out how much toilet paper am I using? How much towels? That type of thing. And then it shows up at your front door. For a limited time, when listeners go to grove.co/majority, you're going to get a free 5-piece gift set from Mrs. Myers in festive holiday scents like peppermint or Iowa pine. The pine I can do. Go to grove.co/majority to get this exclusive holiday offer. It's grove.co/majority. Also, I think a lot of people go through with this. You have an important day. Maybe you're coming on a show. And then it turns out, pimple. Sorry.
Oh, no.
Yeah. We don't do makeup around here. So you got to come in with your best game face. And but with Proactive MD, you got a solution. It's America's number one acne brand. Proactive has helped fight acne for almost 25 years, and now they've introduced their next generation acne treatment, Proactive MD, which contains a dermatologist recommended topical retinoid called adapalene. I first heard about that from my former father-in-law. I don't know, we still haven't figured out what I call him, who is a dermatologist. And this is the newest acne fighting innovation that's been made available over the counter consumers in over 30 years. Kelly, big long time, not, she doesn't like it when I call her old Kelly. Formerly Kelly here, former producer Kelly, producer really emeritus. I mean, she still actually does some work for us. She says that she's been using Proactive on and off since high school. The formula has improved over the years, but the idea has remained the same. Proactive is a program of skincare that gives you short and long-term results. It's the best acne-fighting product that doesn't require a prescription, and it's been that way for a long time. I have sensitive skin, she writes. Proactive's program has made my skin smoother, clearer, without causing redness or peeling. It only takes a few weeks to achieve noticeable differences in your skin. Confidence makes all the difference, and going back to school or going into work or whatever it is leaves one with one less thing to worry about. Proactive is so reliable. It fights acne, improves the brightness and overall appearance of my skin. It's the best regimen I've ever used. So says producer Meredith Kelly. And right now, our listeners can go to proactive.com/majority, receive an exclusive on-the-go bag, which features Proactive's T-Zone Oil Absorber, body acne wipes and green tea moisturizer. That's close to $100 value. There's a 60-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's proactive.com/majority. Proactive, proactive.com/majority to order and get clear skin for the win, as it was, ladies and gentlemen, or as it were. So, folks, I guess we don't take a break because we have in studio, I'd like to introduce. Oh, and I should say that we're going to put all those links in our podcast description and in our YouTube description. Joining me now on set, Aaron Kleinman. He is the director of research for Future Now. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Aaron, what is Future Now?
So Future Now and its associated PAC, Future Now Fund, we are the people that are trying to spread the gospel that the most powerful politicians that nobody talks about are state legislators. Basically, under the Constitution, we have devolved so much power to the states, and we really saw that power devolve, not really since the 70s for Democrats, but particularly during the Obama era. And so a lot of people woke up on election night or after election night in 2016, and they saw Republicans didn't just have the presidency. They had control of everything else. And, you know, hey, getting rid of Trump in 2020, that's really important that we have. It's something we have to do. But it's going to be a colossal effort, and it's going to be very tough for, you know, just small groups of individuals to really impact that. But where small groups of individuals can have a massive impact, be it with, you know, just time or money, is in state legislative races. And so we have focused on flipping chambers in a number of different states. So in 2019, we were able to flip the Virginia House.
I want to dig in more in that, and just to pull your microphone a little bit closer to you.
Sure.
You can just, there you go, exactly. And I should say that, and I've told this story probably half a dozen times over the past couple of years, and I finally put two and two together. Within days after the 2016 election, I don't know, maybe it was a month or 2 months, I can't remember.
Because we were all in kind of a fugue state.
It's true. And time dilation, according to Mike Cernovich. And a buddy of mine said, let's go to this meeting with this state senator from New York. And it was one of, I think I went to probably four meetings that were predominantly women, not even predominantly, like 95%. And some that were specifically women's groups that were having meetings about getting involved in politics. And each one I went to had a very similar theme, which was, we can get the most value out of our buck in impacting state races, state legislatures across the country. And particularly, this is in the wake of, you know, multiple places where Democrats would win the majority of votes in a state and then lose dramatically the majority of state legislature seats because of redistricting. We'll talk about that because a lot of the work you do is that is a sort of a North Star, I think, is the redistricting that's happening in 2010. But so the talk I went to was in the basement of like a yoga studio or something like that. And Daniel Squadron, who was a state senator, parts of Brooklyn, I'm not sure where else, but
Lower Manhattan.
And he gave an amazing presentation that seemed to be fairly ad hoc. And he was trying to organize this group to raise money and adopt essentially like some races in other states. And he made the case. There were two big things, themes that were raised there. One was this idea of like, you folks in this room could raise enough money to dramatically change the outcome of a state Senate race because the amount of dollars that people deal with are so limited. He talked also about ALEC, which was the American Legislative Exchange Council, which I think, you know, this audience is probably somewhat familiar with. It is a group that has created model legislation that Republican lawmakers go and they grab it and they impose it in their states, which is why we solve this. You know, even starting with Scott Walker back in the day in 2011, you know, just sort of modeling this legislation. And he also talked about the IDW or the IDC, I should say. he did not talk about the IDW. He talked about the IDC in New York State. And that subsequent in 2018, that all got demolished, which was that sort of like group of Democrats who were caucusing with Republicans and basically thwarting any progressive change in New York with, you know, of course, Andrew Cuomo. And he went on to he ended up not running for re-election and starting this group. Is that right?
That's correct. He founded the group in 2017. We've been in operation for 2 years, and we worked in six states in the 2017-2018 cycle, and we're growing that to 13 in 2019 and 2020.
Okay, so let's just do a little look back.
Yeah.
And then we'll look forward. You guys went out and you isolated six states in which you felt that what? You could change the balance of power there?
Yeah. So when you're talking about state legislative races, the most important thing to look at isn't necessarily, a seat that you can flip, in isolation. It's you want to affect the balance of power in a state, be that breaking a supermajority that overrides a governor's vetoes like we had in North Carolina, or winning a majority in a chamber like we attempted in Maine, New Hampshire, Arizona, and Michigan. In Maine and New Hampshire, we were able to flip the legislatures. Arizona and Michigan, we made gains, but we fell a little short, and we're hoping to finish the job in 2020, along with a bunch of other states where we're trying to either flip chambers, break supermajorities, or protect majorities.
The governor count, just in terms of governors, and because this implicates the importance of states, has the balance of power has, I don't know if it's fully shifted, but it's changed, hasn't it, over the past couple of years?
Oh, yes. Since Trump became president, I think of 2016, it was really election results from before 2016. You can't quite disregard them, but they are becoming less and less relevant because you've seen him really scramble the political alignments in America, where suburbs have really zoomed to the left and rural areas just keep bleeding Democratic support. And that, moreover, Democrats are now turning out more in lower turnout elections. If you look during the Obama era, 2014 was maybe the worst year ever for Democrat elected officials. I mean, at least in this century, maybe since the 50s or something, Democrats just did not turn out in these lower turnout elections. Since Trump was elected, that has not been the case. And you're seeing Democrats turn out for these elections, and you're seeing that affect the balance of power in these states. And when you affect the balance of power in the state, that means you affect people's lives, because a state government in particular has a lot more interaction with the day-to-day life of a person. I mean, you think of yourself as like a New Yorker who took, the train to work today. The federal government might, have some grants for the MTA, but the day-to-day running of that is in Albany. Whether you're covered by Medicare, your health insurance, the rules governing health insurance in your state, again, it's all from your state legislature. The federal government, has a massive impact on big, diffuse things, but your state government has so much more of a day-to-day impact on your life. And Democrats really, for decades, had been ignoring that. And so we're hoping, to really reverse the tide. And as Daniel had said, the people in that room, they ended up having an impact. They ended up, I'm sure that the people in that room ended up flipping, Maine or New Hampshire or Virginia. And if that, if Democrats kind of think strategically like this and realize in these federal races, Democrats will have enough money for those generally. I mean, we've seen that. We saw that in 2018. Money wasn't the problem. And there were some state races where Democrats, especially in state legislatures, where Democrats really could have used more money. And so we want people to focus on those races more and really realize you can make so much more of an impact, not just in the election, but actually, in people's lives by focusing on state legislatures.
And this also implicates gerrymandering and redistricting that's going to be huge in 2020.
Absolutely. Voting is the right from which all other rights spring. And if you can't vote for a legislature that reflects the will of the people, then the majority of the people is thwarted. So 2020 is going to be the big election for governing who's going to be in charge of maps in a lot of states. For example, North Carolina. We're going back to the North Carolina House there, because in North Carolina, the governor does not have a veto. It all comes down to the legislature there. And so North Carolina has had scads of litigation about just how gerrymandered they are. And if you've been following the news, there was that
racially gerrymandered.
It's basically Jim Crow stuff down there. And I've been following the news. I mean, just the lengths at which Republicans went to thwart the will of the majority there are, it's almost mind-boggling. We're still trying to catch up to, how badly They gerrymandered the state. Wisconsin is another state where, again, Democrats keep winning a majority of state legislative votes, but it's so horribly gerrymandered that they barely get above 40% of the seats in the legislature.
Right. It's they won 53% in the last election.
I think it was 52 or 53. And
they, Republicans had 64% of the seats.
Democrats flipped to one seat, so they're down to 63 in the House. Yeah.
Right. Fair enough. That's just bizarre. I feel like that, you know, if the American public could sort of really absorb the implications of that. I mean, to a certain extent, we see that on a national level, right? I mean, at least there's an electoral college that's not supposed to be set up that way in the state level.
Yes.
Okay, so let's look at 2019 because, you know, want to see what happened in 2019. There's largely the news was good. There are some caveats. And I want to talk more about this rural-urban divide because, you know, the big question is like, are the Republican policies in terms of rural America that much better for rural America than the Democrats' policies? Or is there something else going on?
No, they aren't. It's really what's happening is there's an increasing fusion of your political and cultural identity, and the Republican, you know, political and cultural identity is focused more on rural areas where, you know, it's not just, you know, living far apart from someone doesn't necessarily make you a conservative. It's the demographics of rural areas that really kind of help turbocharge that. They're less diverse than suburbs and cities. They're a lot older than suburbs and cities. The kind of separate nature of the people and kind of the idea that you have to be more self-sufficient, less of a communitarian, ethic there, I guess. I think that does play a smaller role, but you know, they're wider, more church going, older. And so because those are demographics shifting toward Republicans, Democrats keep losing ground in rural areas. Now, that's not to say Democrats can't stem that tide. One really interesting thing we saw in 2018 was actually while rural areas are older than average, there are still plenty of young voters in there. And the young voters in rural areas actually were a bright spot in 2018. They really bounced back toward Democrats. And, you know, Democrats don't have to win rural areas to win the presidency. They just need to do as well as John Kerry did in rural areas to win the presidency and then just hope that.
Okay. So one thing that I think people need to understand, and I still like sometimes I have trouble wrapping my head around this, is that there is, you know, we keep hearing stories of like Donald Trump finding more votes out there. Mm-hmm. And these are not people who were like, I used to be a Democrat, but now I'm voting for Trump. Or is it? Or is it just like there are more people? There's just like, I'm the type of person who would vote for Trump. I just don't vote. And then I decide I'm going to vote. Or which one is that?
It's a mixture of those. I think you have a lot of people in rural areas that, if you look at the 2016 election results, I mean, I know, like we said earlier, we were kind of in a fugue state after that. I mean, I remember like when election night was starting and looking at those first rural counties coming in, and I thought, wow, there's no way Trump can keep this up everywhere. But he was winning by like 70% instead of like 60, you know, he's winning 70% in rural areas like Pennsylvania and Michigan, where Obama or where Mitt Romney only got like 60%. And it was a mixture of Democratic turnout in those areas collapsed. Like the Clinton campaign, there were issues just turning out voters outside major metros, and the turnout in those areas just totally collapsed. But I think there is this element of the Trump campaign. You know, he spoke to people who might see themselves as, you know, outside the political process. There are a lot of non-voters that it turns out he was able to turn out in these races. I think, you know, if you're living in a rural area and a non-voter, think about, you know, like the news sources you have, AM radio, you know.
Right.
You know, your local newspaper has been hollowed out and you get your news from like a Facebook group. I mean, think, you know, you tend to be older and wider and church going. You know,
don't know, too, I should say, that when you compare the clearance numbers of an MSNBC. Now, I think, you know, particularly over the past 3 or 4 years, they've been increasingly populated by Republicans. I mean, MSNBC, I mean, that's a publicly, I mean, people know that. I think there's been stories to that effect. Andy Lack wants to take the network more, you know, sort of old style Republican, as it were, whatever. But the point being, just as a counterpoint to Fox, Fox has clearance, in other words, a carriage on cable networks throughout the middle of the country. And CNN, to a certain extent, MSNBC almost exclusively on the coasts, I should say, more or less. And, you know, which gives you a sense of, like, who, you know, obviously who their market is. And you see this also, you know, they're, even the broadcast networks have different emphasis on who they feel they're appealing to. ABC, much more heartland than, let's say, NBC. Yeah. But all these places, the news sources are Fox, Rush Limbaugh, or someone worse or similar, and a crappy local newspaper that's, you know, probably owned by similarly situated people.
Also, keep in mind that local news, like local television news, I mean, that's one of the biggest conservative media sources that nobody talks about. Even if it's not necessarily like a Sinclair station, I mean, local news, I don't know if you've, you know, watched it. I mean, I don't really watch it in New York City, but like I see, you know, promos during football. It's always like, you know, shooting here, crime here. What are you, you know, what's going to kill your kid today? It's very fear-based, very regressive news. And, you know, if you're a Democrat trying to reach those people, I mean, you know, they've been living in a different information, you know, network from a lot of Democrats. So, you know,
and so younger people, though, who are turning out, it's because they're basically spending their time on different media, or is it they just they're exposed to more things?
I mean, I think if you're a younger person in a rural area, I mean, you're probably a little more educated than maybe people older than you, maybe a little less likely to attend church. Yeah, you probably have a different information network, or at the very least, you've been exposed to different information networks. I mean, if you're like a 60-year-old living in a rural area, you know, when's the last time that you had any access to, you know, like, I mean, if you're on Twitter, you're not following anyone remotely liberal. I'm sure just if you're younger, you probably just have a different information diet, basically. And, you know, it's a generational divide as well, where just younger people tend to be more liberal. And that doesn't matter, you know, that, you know, you're more liberal than, I'm more liberal than older people in New York. And then someone living in, you know, Mankato, Minnesota is more liberal than an older person in Mankato, Minnesota.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about 2019 a little bit, because there were special elections. Let's work backwards, shall we?
Sure.
So let's start with Louisiana. What are we to make of Louisiana? Was that just a foregone conclusion that John Bel Edwards would win? Is that indicative of Donald Trump not having sort of the coattails, or is that just he has coattails? They're just bigger negative coattails than his positive ones.
Well, so Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, I mean, like, as you mentioned at the top of the show, he put, you know, 500,000 people on Medicaid. He focused on, you know, increasing teacher pay. He inherited Bobby Jindal's horrible budget and he fixed it. So he's always a popular guy, but he still is in a Republican state. And so going into the runoff against Eddie Rispone, the Republican he was running against, you know, the question was, you know, can a Democrat still win with all these Republican headwinds against him? And he did. He, you know, as you also hinted to, he's pro-gun, he's pro-life. And so that kind of helped neutralize some of the attacks on him. But he still bled a lot of support in rural areas, and he was able to increase it. He had great African-American support, I think, you know, and the anecdotal stories coming out of Louisiana are that, you know, the Trump visits actually really helped goose African-American support for Edwards.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, the main takeaway that I think is really applicable globally is, you know, if there were some type of, you know, Republican anti-impeachment resentment that was really energizing their voters, they would have swamped Democrats in Louisiana. But I will also say that, you know, turnout was way up. It was higher than it was in the primary. It was higher
turnout for both Republicans and Democrats.
So, you know, it could be that impeachment is energizing both sides about as much. You know, in a 2019 Louisiana Saturday runoff, it's hard to, you know, project that out to 2020. It's just a different type of election. But you're seeing that Republicans and Democrats are both being animated really by, and we've seen this, you know, nationwide, you know, people are animated by how they feel about Trump. He dominates everything in the political space. How does impeachment play into that? Well, it seems like it just plays into these kind of pre-existing narratives about Trump so far, where Democrats and Republicans are both seem to be motivated by what's going on in the news.
I don't want to get ahead of myself, but it's the implications of impeachment are going to be different in these type of races, when you're talking about a senator or a congressperson, right? Because they're going to actually have to make an affirmative, explicit statement, essentially, a vote on what they think about Donald Trump. And if the Democrats do it right, it's going to be you and Donald Trump sitting in a tree, K-Y-S-S-I-N-G, if you vote to not impeach him, right?
Well, I mean, I think it's you and Donald Trump sitting in a tree, C-O-R-R-U-P-T. Yeah, corrupt. I mean, corruption has to be the message.
Corrupting?
Corrupting.
What is the verb for that? What would you do? Corrupting. I think C-U-R-R-U-P-T-I-N-G would be the way to do it.
I think the syllables work a little better without the...
All right. Well, whatever.
Yeah. No,
I think people get the point.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, Democrats in 2020 is going to be a referendum on Trump no matter what. You know, any presidential reelection campaign is going to be a referendum on them. And I think, you know, nationally, Democrats need to make it, you know, any federal office holder, if you stand with Trump, you're for corruption, basically. And if a Republican dares vote against Trump, I mean, they risk the wrath of their base.
Right.
And so, you know, an impeachment, you know, was always going to be that play where ultimately you're just forcing Republicans to take a stand. Because even in 2018, you had Republicans nationwide being like, well, you know, I don't agree with everything he tweets and he's been good for the economy. So, you know, and you can still vote for me. I'm one of the normal ones. But if you are on record voting for this guy,
it
makes it much harder.
All right. Well, we'll circle back to that because I want to keep going back in time.
All right.
Kentucky. Matt Bevin loses. Andy Beshear wins. How much should we read into that?
I really am hesitant to read too much into that in terms of implications for 2019, other than, again, if Trump really were energizing Republicans nationwide, he would have been able to get Matt Bevin over the hump there. But, you know, again, Matt Bevin, you know,
I mean, that's a relevant story, it seems to me, that because everybody would have assumed that his ability to activate these other voters would overwhelm, and it's not. And when we're looking, it's hard because we don't have an apples to apples type of comparison.
It isn't, you know, I mean, that's any projection after 2020 is, you know, it's a bit of, you know, you're putting together little bits of evidence here and there to see what it all adds up to. And so no one, you know, you can't overdetermine any one election result, you know, be it the Kentucky governor's race or the Mississippi governor's race, for example, or, you know, state legislative races in New Jersey or Virginia. You know, that on their own, those don't tell you much. But when you take everything we've learned to date together, it tells a story. And I think the story we've seen from 2019, and that includes Kentucky, is that there is no kind of counter-revolutionary force out there that's ready to kind of flood the polls to vote Republican. But that said, it's not as if, you know, Andy Beshear rode a, you know, blue wave, so to speak, into office. You know, he really ran on, you know, I don't think people really appreciate just how unpopular, and with good reason, Matt Bevin was. He, you know, really alienated a lot of people on purpose. He went after the school, you know, he went after teachers directly a lot in the state. And, you know, the thing about going after teachers, you know, specifically like targeting them is, you know, there are teachers everywhere, and you know, parents tend to like their kids' teachers, and parents tend to vote. And so, you know, again, when you're talking about, you know, just keeping down Republican margins in rural areas, one way to do that is to have your teachers pissed at a Republican. And, you know, listen, they're not going to win over all the parents, but they'll win over some parents. And that's the difference between winning and losing.
I talked to my comrades in Kentucky, too, who said a big issue was the bridge tax.
Yes.
It was a bridge going to the suburbs of northern Kentucky, where there are a lot of people who might have voted Republican, but they were pissed at Bevin because they didn't want to pay the tax.
Yeah. You remember the Covington Catholic kid?
Yes.
Yeah. That county, you know, MAGA territory, but it's a suburb where it's a little more educated. And Democrats really, I mean, Beshear won because he totally cut into Trump's margins in that area. This very conservative area. It's a suburb, but it's a suburban area, a little more upscale, a little more culturally upscale. And then Bevin was alienating all these people who have to get into Cincinnati every day by, you know, with this bridge tax issue. And, you know, Beshear was able to ride that to victory. So, you know, Bevin was just such a uniquely unpopular guy that Beshear was able to beat him in Kentucky. You know, that said,
and Trump could not overcome that.
Right. And I mean, if you want to take, I guess, more a more global lesson from there is, you know, Trump is also a guy who likes to alienate specific groups. And whoever the Democratic nominee is, I mean, I think you need to focus on, you know, activating some of those groups that he is really alienating in particular. And if you want to talk about rural America, you know, run on those tariffs that he's that have just been ravaging them. And his agriculture secretary telling, you know, dairy farmers that, you know, hey, there needs to be few of you guys. We want more consolidation.
We need to call dairy farmers.
Yeah,
we need,
yeah. So you know, I think, you know, and I have seen some of, you know, I think there have been some big Democratic groups that have really been working on that messaging a year out. So I hope to see more of that.
And so, all right, so let's go backwards. And then we have the Virginia and Pennsylvania were two states where, I mean, Virginia, let's talk about both those states because they were good, not quite as good as maybe one would hope.
Yeah. So in Virginia, you know, let's start with Virginia, where the state Democrats flipped both chambers of the state legislature. They have they have a governing trifecta in the state for the first time in, I think, 30 years. And like a progressive, you know, and 30 years ago, the Virginia Democrats in charge were not exactly progressive.
Right.
So this is, you know, a progressive majority in Virginia for the first time in a long time. And so there are a lot of kind of policy imperatives that they can take on now around, you know, expanding affordable health care and investing in kids and good jobs and clean water and resilient infrastructure, all those great things. And so, you know, the material impact of this is great. They flip both chambers. But we saw some Republicans, especially kind of the savvier Republican politicians in Virginia, were able to distance themselves from Trump. And if you looked at the races they ran, they were running on like the same issues that Democrats normally run. It's like, oh, I'm going to protect schools. Oh, I'm going to protect, you know, us from, you know, rising waters. You know, because like Norfolk, Virginia, for example, has some of the worst climate change flooding of anywhere in the United States. And you saw Republicans, you know, running on, you know, sea barriers and, you know, and renewables. And, you know, Trump's name didn't come up. And so you saw they gave Republicans a blueprint for winning in tough races in Virginia. And it is run the hell away from Trump in suburban areas. Now, in 2020, especially again, if you force Republicans to vote on impeachment.
Exactly.
You can't really do that.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that I think is, I mean, they seem to me to be running as the old school Republicans who are like, we all agree on the problems. We just happen to think that business can take care of the solution more, right? Which is basically what the, we're just going to pretend like we care about these, the same problems and we have just different solutions. Which we now refer to those people as like, what is it? The isn't there like a solutions caucus now or something?
The problem solver caucus,
like third way,
type of.
And so let's move to Pennsylvania because, you know, you said you saw those rural districts in Pennsylvania coming back with sort of astonishing numbers in 2016. In terms of like the how he was running up the score in those deficits. And we have one of our regular listeners who now has a show on Twitch. I can't remember what Mike's from PA's. What is it called?
Oh.
I can't remember. He's going to kill me. But he called in the day after and he said Central Committee on Twitch. Folks, check it out. He called in the day after the election and said, you know, he works in Democratic politics. He said, we're doing get out the vote. The Clinton campaign, because they weren't doing a big field program beforehand, they were just using algorithms. And the day, before the election, we get out the vote effort, 25% of the houses that they're knocking on were Trump voters because their numbers were all, their lists were all screwed up because they were knocking on doors that the algorithm said should have been Clinton voters. And it just turns out that like one quarter of the people you're telling to go to the polls are your opponent's voters. So what works in those situations? Is it really just a matter of a Democratic candidate needs to find certain pockets in those areas, certain like demographic pockets where they can say, push on one issue just to mitigate their loss there and then run it up in the cities? Is that basically the plan?
I think it's a more holistic approach. You know, I think First of all, don't use an algorithm to say that you don't have to do field. I think that will be a good first step.
Right. But that's exactly what I'm – that's the lesson I learned from my run against Schumer, if that happens. But we can talk about that later.
So if you're going out to these rural communities, I think, again, it's like you want to frame progressive issues in a way that, you know, speaks to them. I mean, you want to meet people where they are. And so, for example, talking about healthcare, for example, I think it's great that, you know, wide swaths of our base thinks that healthcare is a human right, and that really activates our base. But when you go out to these places, healthcare is a human right, it's not a compelling message. It's really, you know, what you want to say is, you know, it's like, we want everyone to have affordable health care. We want life expectancy to improve. We want you to not get surprise bills anymore. You want to, you know, I think you want to campaign on the idea that these issues that you're running on will have a material impact on people's lives. And so that's, I think, how you message in those areas. And I think it's also just don't write off those areas just because they're, you know, I mean, again, it seems like there was a lot of, you know, for their field programs are writing off rural areas. You know, again, you don't need to win rural areas.
Right.
You just need to lose them by the same amount that Kerry lost them by.
Right.
And then you win.
Right. And so that's the problem, is if you abandon these things, you're not in any way mitigating the loss, and you need to mitigate the loss a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, you know, in Pennsylvania, you don't get like a special prize for running up the score a lot in the, you know, Philadelphia suburbs. You know, you got to win votes wherever you can. You know, a vote in rural Cambria County counts just as much as a vote in Philadelphia there.
I can't remember if it was Ed Rollins. His name escapes me. The former Ed Rendell.
Yeah.
Or if it was Chuck Schumer, who said, for every blue collar worker we lose in Pittsburgh, we're going to pick up three in the Philadelphia suburbs, or something to that effect.
Well, you know, they got that right, just the numbers backwards.
So, okay. All right. That was what I was curious as to, like, what exactly, which end of that did they get wrong? And they got both ends wrong.
Well, I mean, they understood that there was a trade-off between rural voters and suburban ones, and they just didn't appreciate that the trade-off might work in the other direction.
Well, that's good. At least they understood that there's a dynamic that goes on. people are going to vote. I got that part right. So, all right. And so one of the things that Virginia, just to sum up, Virginia and Pennsylvania tell us is that they're driving out. As much as Democrats are pushing the boundaries of get out the vote that we've seen at least in decades in many respects,
yeah,
they are too.
Yeah. So, you know, going into 2020, one thing that we're pretty sure of is that there's going to be record turnout. There are going to be a lot of people who've never voted before voting for the first time. And what we're trying to figure out is what those people look like. Now, I think there's kind of this tendency in liberal circles to see those people, they're going to vote Democratic no matter what. But how many of those people are like that, you know, those people we were talking about earlier, you know, people in a rural area who've had a conservative information diet, who might not, you know, really see politics as very relevant to them. All of a sudden, you know, Trump's kind of there screwing everything up in Washington, D.C., fighting those pointy-headed elites. There could be plenty of those. And, you know, in the Pennsylvania, they had kind of their county elections, and we saw that in those more conservative areas that still, you know, kind of had traditionally Democratic governments, and then similarly, you know, these these suburbs that are turning blue in the Philadelphia suburbs that have traditionally been run by Republicans, you're seeing that, you know, there are motivated voters on both sides willing to turn out kind of the historically, you know, dominant parties. If those historically dominant parties aren't willing to really kind of adapt to these new electorates.
So when you look across the states, and maybe, I don't know, maybe this is proprietary information you don't want to tell because you don't want the Republicans to know this, but what I imagine they have, you know, they can do the same analysis on some level.
Yeah.
What states are the ones that are not necessarily the low hanging fruit, but the lowest hanging fruit for Democrats to flip in terms of like state legislatures or, you know, get control of the states or whatever the metric you use there is?
Yeah. So heading into 2020, you know, Pennsylvania and Michigan are two states that we're really interested in. And, you know, there are Democrats in both states are just a few seats shy of in Pennsylvania, House and Senate are both up. And so we could get majorities in both. Michigan, the Senate isn't up in presidential years, but we could flip the House. Kansas, actually, people don't think of Kansas as a particularly fruitful area, but Kansas has a lot of well-educated voters who traditionally vote Republican. They also have a Democratic governor who faces bare supermajorities in both chambers. And so a small investment in the Kansas legislature will make it so that Republicans can't override her vetoes. In Iowa, we're just three seats shy of a majority in the House, and you have a lot of areas in Iowa, in the Iowa House, that went from Obama to Trump, and it's winning those voters back. And how do you do that? Those are some of the states that we're really most interested in, probably some of the lowest hanging fruit. And then also, you know, we barely, you know, it was close in 2018 when we won majorities in Maine and New Hampshire. And, you know, Maine, they've passed really a lot of progressive legislation there around, you know, prescription drug prices and red flag laws and renewables. And so, but, you know, Republicans are going to be gunning for flipping back the state Senate there. We want to make sure that we can keep it. In New Hampshire, you know, if a few hundred votes flip in the state Senate there, Democrats don't take that chamber. And then they could also, and they still have a Republican governor there, but you could actually, you know, the Republican governorship is up every 2 years in New Hampshire. And so you could actually get a trifecta in New Hampshire. So that's just some of the lower hanging fruit there. Also, North Carolina, now that they have new maps, we're working with the North Carolina House, which did not vote for, you know, the Republican, you know, we're not working with the Senate. We don't really know what they did with the maps there, but
right.
But you know, in North Carolina, especially if you care about redistricting, the governor does not have a say in redistricting in North Carolina. So if you really want to flip the North Carolina House, they're just five seats shy, and they got a new map that made a lot more Republicans endangered. And so that's another exciting opportunity as well.
Okay, I got two more questions. One, give me the. You said in Iowa, there's a lot of Obama to Trump voters.
Yes.
Like, what do you have a sense of, like, What was that dynamic there?
I have the sense that antipathy to Clinton, I think, was a big deal there.
Uniquely towards Clinton.
I think, you know, some of that carried through to other Democrats. I mean, you know, Iowa really. I'm sure, you know, because I look at the district level at all these things, and I'm shocked at just, you know, how big the spreads are between some races. There are people who really split tickets in Iowa, and I'm fascinated by the state, and I wanted, you know, I really am trying to learn more about, you know, what this dynamic is. I think, you know, we've seen stories where people there kind of, you know, I think they were just kind of wanted something new a little bit in 2016, and Clinton didn't represent that. And I, you know, I think Obama to Trump voters nationwide, they've done a lot of stories on those vote switching. I think, you know, anti-immigration views were a big driver of that. I'd be interested to see if that really carries to Iowa as well. I think that the anti-immigration thing really was more in, I think, like New York, for example, when we saw like Staten Island went very red. And I think that was a big part of that there in like Suffolk County. I'm not quite sure how much that, you know, I'd be fascinated to really dig deeper into the Iowa specific Obama Trump voters. But, you know, you were able to see in 2018, Democrats win back a lot of those. And I think a lot of it's just people wanting something new, but also there is the dynamic where you have the rural urban divergence. And in Iowa, a lot of the ground we gained back in 2018 was in Des Moines, was, you know, in Dubuque, was in Cedar Rapids. You know, they're these smaller cities, but they're, you know, cities nonetheless more educated than average.
So didn't make up, didn't recapture those Obama to Trump voters, but overcame them by driving up numbers in areas that were more sympathetic to Democrats.
Well, so you want to talk about proprietary, but actually we've come up with a measure, we call it the Comey coefficient. We're still working out some, but basically it, we try to use the demographics of a state legislative seat to predict how much Democrats will over or underperform the Clinton baseline. And the three things it really takes into account are the white population, because she did poorly among white voters relative to other Democrats, the poverty rate, actually, because areas with higher poverty, she tended to do poorly in, relative to other Democrats. And then people who have some college education, another. And if you look at Iowa and like the Comey coefficients there, you see a lot of areas that she lost in like the eastern part of the state along the Mississippi River, where Democrats have really had been able to hang on to, you know, their seats with somewhat ease. And it's just, you know, for whatever reason, those, you know, kind of people, there are a lot of people there who just didn't like Clinton, but will still vote for Democrats. And there are a lot of those in kind of the eastern part of Iowa. And so hopefully, you know, a lot of them kind of went back in 2018, and we're hoping that, you know, in 2020, we can carry that forward. In addition to flipping, you know, again, kind of erstwhile Republican voters in like the Des Moines suburbs and Cedar Rapids, Dubuque, et cetera.
Comey as in Jim Comey?
You know,
okay, you're having fun with it. Okay,
we're having fun with the name of it.
You math nerds, you got to come up with your, you got to come up with stuff like that. I guess the
you get the alliteration with Comey coefficient too.
No, I got it. I get it. all right. So, lastly, right before the show, we were talking about Maine, and the story of impeachment in my mind has always been about that dynamic, particularly in the Senate, although, you know, to some extent in the House as well, although I don't think there's going to be as many opportunities for it. You know, a lot of the House has sorted itself out. There's not a lot of people running for the Republicans who are holding on to their seat, who are like, I'm a Republican, but I keep some distance from Trump. That doesn't happen in the House anymore. Those people have more or less, that animal is gone.
One thing to keep in mind when talking about the U.S. House is just it really is like a bad job. Like you have to live in two places and you have to spend like every waking minute raising money. And so if you're a Republican who really just kind of got into this to crush the poor, but don't really like want to engage in these kind of Trumpian culture wars, you tap out. You already retired.
Yeah, right. You already retired.
Why bother? Become a lobbyist. Right. That'll be so much easier.
And there, I mean, I don't know. You would know this probably better than I would, but there can't be more than, if there are any, I mean, I think there's some, but not many seats where like Hillary Clinton won the district and the Republican won, the Republican congressperson won.
Oh, no, exactly. There are three left.
Three.
There are three
in the entire country.
And one of them's retiring.
Okay. So, I mean, so that's not in play, but there's a half a dozen of those, it seems to me, in the Senate, right? About... I mean, people who want to sort of be Republican, but want to keep Donald Trump at arm's length to some degree.
Well, I mean, in the Senate, you have to keep in mind that up in 2020, there are only two Republicans in seats in states that voted for Clinton. There are other Republicans in states that could vote for the 2020 nominee, like Arizona. There are two in Georgia now, Iowa. North Carolina, you know, those are all going to be targets to varying degrees.
Colorado, obviously.
Yeah, Colorado and Maine are the two.
Right, okay.
And then, of course, you have to keep in mind that we have to defend Doug Jones in Alabama.
Right. Okay. So with that said, the idea is that Democrats want to not just make this a referendum on Trump, but to marry those senators in those states to Donald Trump.
Yeah. You know, because... what we saw in 2018 and you know, really since Trump was elected, Republicans in more marginal seats, you know, it's the, oh, I don't agree with everything he tweets and,
right.
You know, I don't think all this stuff, but, you know, he's good for the economy. And so I'm going to keep supporting him on some things. And then if you're, you know, this won't be as much of the case in, you know, state and local, and, you know, Republicans can still run away from him a bit in these state legislative races, though with, you know, they're going to have to go with whatever the national tide is and try to figure out. But, you know, in these federal races, you know, these Republicans, they're going to have to take a stand on, you know, do you support, and in Democratic messaging needs to be on, you know, do you support corruption? You know, there's, you see these Republican attempts at obfuscation, at, you know, marginalia, at, you know, trying to make all these weird process points. And I think, you know, Democrats just need to kind of keep pounding the, you know, if you vote to either not impeach him or if you vote to not convict him, you are supporting corruption.
So Susan Collins, you basically said she has, well, I mean, she has two choices, obviously, on how she's going to vote there.
Yeah.
But in terms of what one choice or the other would signal, like, and it never occurred to me that she could try and get away with this. But you know Maine. You guys worked in Maine this last cycle. You suggested that the other thing she could do is go full on LePage. I mean, not full on LePage,
right.
But because I don't even think LePage can go full on LePage.
Right. I mean, I think what I want to disabuse people of is the idea that Maine is a blue state. You know, it voted for Clinton by, I think, about 3 points. It splits its electoral votes, and its more rural congressional seat voted for Trump by more than 10 points. I think Collins would be fine just, you know, or for her personally, I think she would be okay, you know, saying, hey, I support Donald Trump in these things. I think that impeachment's a witch hunt, sham, whatever. And she'll, you know, basically try to really crank up Republican turnout and hope. And, you know, keep in mind, in Maine, you have a lot of rural blue collar Democrats there that she can try to flip.
The idea being that she goes, if I'm in for a penny, I'm in for a pound. If I'm going to vote for him, I might as well milk as much out of that vote as I can and not worry about trying to cut, you know, and basically cut my losses and milk as much as I can out of that vote, as opposed to trying to sort of like thread the needle.
Yeah.
And she's got to make that decision fairly early, it seems to me. Like, after she makes that vote, she's got to basically then become a, you know, basically do what we just saw. What was her face in the intelligence hearings?
Yeah.
Stefanik. Yeah.
And by the way, I mean, her district in the basically Adirondacks and north of New York, not that dissimilar from Maine. That district, or especially the rural portions of Maine. I mean, that district, like that one in rural Maine, is voted for Obama twice and then went to Trump. And, it, you know, you have that rural urban divergence, and there's still, you know, Portland is a growing area. It's a very liberal area, but there's a lot of rural area in Maine too. And if Susan Collins, you know, she could be like, listen, I know that I can get something like 47% of the vote, no matter what, is going to vote for me. And then I just try to get that other 3-4% at the margins. That's a strategic choice that she can make. Maine's a purple state. It's not a blue state. And so she's not just an automatic out. And, you know, we have to keep the state, and again, like this, get further down the ballot. You know, the state Senate there, we flipped that and we've been able to pass all this great progressive legislation. But Susan Collins and Donald Trump are going to try to, you know, create kind of a red wave in Maine that might undo all that. And so Maine is going to be a critical 2020 state.
I wonder if Dianne Feinstein, wasn't it Dianne Feinstein came out and said she didn't want to see Susan Collins go from the Senate? She said that. I wonder if she will go and, you know, if she will join Susan Collins if she moves in that direction. Yeah, it was Dianne Feinstein. That'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But Aaron Kleiman, the group is Future Now Fund. If people want to get involved in that in some fashion, how would they go about doing that?
Futurenow.org.
Go get a math degree.
No.
All right.
You don't need a math degree. You just need to trust people. You have to trust that we know what we're doing.
Trust mathematicians.
I'm actually not a mathematician. I'm a lawyer, but I'm conversant in math.
Okay.
Go to futurenow.org. You can follow us on Twitter at FutureNowUSA. And, you know, we're really, you know, we're trying to flip states, not just, you know, to rack up wins. We're trying to create, you know, progressive governing majorities that are going to improve the lives of the people living in them. And, you know, if all the listeners here are willing to join us, you know, we can make a huge difference in those states.
I would be doing a disservice if I didn't say, like, how easily could someone like Tom Steyer come in and say, like, instead of spending $55 million to get in one debate, you know, four lines in a debate or something like that, I'm going to commit myself to, like, you know, winning a bunch of state races.
Like, so Tom Steyer, like, the amount of money that he had, like, when you're spending in a state, at some point, the money you spend, there's just no marginal value to it. You know, it's like, what's another mailer or radio ad really going to do? So, you know, there's a spending limit in each state of, like, what, you know, money, how much money can really make a difference. And at some point, you know, you can't ultimately buy an election. But Tom Steyer could basically fully fund efforts to flip basically every chamber within reach if he wanted.
Honestly.
Tom, if you're listening, again, it's Future Now USA, futurenow.org. Drop us a line. We'd be happy to talk to you about this.
Wait, is there a better argument for why people shouldn't have that much money than just how irresponsible this guy is with it? In the guise of trying to help.
It's a huge waste.
Oh, my God.
I actually think Tom Steyer is a brilliant man, and he should absolutely talk to Future Now about the work that we're doing in the States.
I mean, it's quite possible he's listening today. I wouldn't bet on it, but Aaron, always a real pleasure. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me on, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to head into that segment of the program that we call the Fun Half, which is available for members. And you can join us by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you not only get it commercial free, but you also get this extra content every single day. So check that out. Also, again, AM Quickie. I should add, if you're someone who can't afford the free show, and people go through very difficult times, but you want the extra content, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will not lock anybody out for lack of funds. And if you want to help the show, but you don't want to spend any money, subscribe to AM Quickie. Let's get this baby up the charts. Could start to, as they say in the business, monetize it and give us a review on iTunes. There's a lot of different things you can do. And I should tell you, is it back? When is it happening with Just Coffee? 30% off, I think, is starting just in days. So check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. See if, I don't know if they've quite started it yet, but 30% off. This is the time to go and try Just Coffee. You can go, you find out which blend you like, you realize you like the Majority Report blend, and then you found your coffee, maybe for the rest of your life. Reminder, this program today was sponsored by, in part, by Proactive. It's, they got their next generation acne treatment system. It's called Proactive MD. It contains an innovative dermatologist-recommended topical retinoid called adapalene. And I know this not just because they Proactive let me know this. I know this because of my former wife's father, who was a dermatologist, who was, you know, prescribed this for my daughter and my ex-wife. But right now, I don't know why I would bring that into an ad, frankly.
It doesn't get more credible than that.
Exactly. Right now, our listeners can go to proactive.com/majority, receive an exclusive on-the-go bag, which has Proactive's T-Zone oil absorber. So your T-Zone oil gets absorbed. Body acne wipes and green tea moisturizer. That's close to $100 value. And there's a 60-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's proactive.com. proactive.com/majority to order and to get clear skin for the win. Jamie, what's next on the Antifada?
I'm so glad you asked. So this week on the Antifada, I spoke with Tom, Terrence, and Tanya of the Trillbilly Workers Party, one of my favorite podcasts, very exciting. We talked a little bit about the elections in Kentucky. We talked about how they all became dyed-in-the-wool radicals, as well as electoral skeptics. We talked about the pitfalls of the Just Transition program, which they have seen tried and failed over and over again in their state. And we also did a little over-under on the success of a protracted people's war in the mountains of Appalachia. So check it out, folks.
Matt.
Yeah, on Literary Hangover on the podcast feed and on YouTube, we did Orinoco or The Royal Slave by Aphra Behn. Aphra Behn is the first English woman to earn her living by the pen. She was also a Tory monarchist spy and not a very well-paid spy, which is why she had to do the writing. Yeah, check all that stuff out, folks.
Imagine being a spy and not getting paid well for it. What a drag. All right, folks, see you in the Fun Half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.